Out is for sale. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for the invite.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Very busy. Every week and every day, working in my line of work in the solutions industry is very, very busy, but that's how I prefer it.
Awesome, man. Yeah, it's good to be busy. It's something about idle hands, you know. Mm-hmm. So good to keep things in focus.
That saying has so much truth in it that it actually made its way into Afrikaans as well. Ledigheid is die duivelse oorkussing.
Oh wow, it sounds so much, it klink baie beter in Afrikaans. Well, I wanted to talk to you really badly. We spoke a long time ago. I came onto your channel, but I've been wanting to have you on my channel for a while, and I actually was going to upload our old conversation, but I mm-hmm. thought I would just have you on and talk about yourself, you know, because sure. I think you're a very interesting guy. You have a very interesting YouTube channel, Conscious Caracal, mm-hmm. which we'll talk about today. But in preparation for this interview, we were WhatsApping and I asked you what's something that you're passionate about, and you actually gave me two things. The first one you said was, well, one of the two you said was you're passionate about the Afrikaner phenomenon and how Westerners can't really fathom it. And then also realistic state-proof solutions to problems. So I'd like to delve into the first one, how Westerners can't really fathom the Afrikaner phenomenon, and maybe start off with just the bare basics and ask you, in your words, what is the Afrikaner phenomenon?
So the Afrikaner phenomenon, it's not an official term. I just used that concept in the moment. But pretty much what I meant there was that you have this group of Westerners in Africa that are constantly try to put in a box, and it just doesn't work. They can't figure out where to put them. The best example, let me demonstrate this with a recent example. So recently, I think it was end of last year. There's a very long story behind it, but I'm just going to give the bare bones of it for the sake of time. Simple background, Morocco and the many people within Morocco are very angry at the grandson of Nelson Mandela. Long story, you can go read why they are on a different day, specifically just surrounding the issue of West Sahara, which Nelson Mandela's grandson said was an occupied territory. He called it a colony of Morocco. And then Moroccan football supporters at a football match put up a banner, massive banner, that said, "Little Mandela, the only colony left in Africa is Urania." Now, if you don't know Urania, is the Afrikaner-only town in South Africa. Now, here's where the distinction comes in, or how people can't understand what the Afrikaner is. So, firstly, many people saw that banner, many Westerners, and immediately deduced, oh, what they mean is that Urania is colonizing South Africa. There's still colonists in South Africa, that town. But then you go read what the Moroccans are saying, and you realize it's completely the opposite. The Moroccans are saying Urania is colonized by the South African government regime, by the ANC regime. It is a colonized town. It is a colonized community. And the distinction between those two interpretations shows you where the issue comes in with Westerners trying to figure out what Afrikaners are. So a Westerner immediately just thinks, oh, white people in Africa, they are either the descendants of colonists or still some serving colonialism in some way. But then you take the Afrikaners and you look at our history and who we are, and it's something completely different. We're not the descendants of any colonial project. We're not the descendants of colonists. We are the mixture of many different peoples that came here for a variety of reasons. The best example is the French Huguenots, which my ancestors are a large portion of my ancestors were French Huguenots. My first ancestor was a French Huguenot, Paul Roux, who came here in 1688. So the French Huguenots, for those that don't know.
Sorry to cut you off, Arons, but just for perspective, I think you mentioned it in the article. That's 100 years before America was even a country, right?
Right.
When he arrived here, that's just for some
perspective. I'm the ninth generation.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's That's the story. I'm not unique. That's the story of most Afrikaners. You can ask them, when did your first ancestor get here? Oh, probably. And they'll probably give you an answer like, oh, 1698, 1705. My fiance's first ancestor came here in 1705. So just a short while after my first ancestor.
You're slightly more local than she is. Anyway, continue.
I've got a little bit of an edge there. So here's the thing. Now you look at where do the ancestors of the Afrikaners come from? Well, one large grouping are these French Huguenots who are fleeing religious persecution in France. And they're Protestants and they come to South Africa just so they can not be killed for their faith or persecuted for their faith, and that they can freely practice their faith. Then you've also got a large grouping of Afrikaner ancestors being the Dutch, but the Dutch aren't here to create a colony. They're just creating an outpost. So when people say, oh, South Africa has been colonized in 1652, and I always think, so what the implication of that is that a small outpost of 50 Dutch sailors so completely conquered and pretty much oppressed an entire region of millions of people. It doesn't make sense. It's a little outpost that they built. Later, they built a castle, and that's it. So you've also, again, you've got, and then many of those Dutch turn into the Vryburgers, people that didn't want anything to do with the Dutch East India Company. They didn't. That's where the first recorded use of the word Afrikaner came from, was Henry Bibeau in Stellenbosch. In somewhere in the early 1700s, I can't remember exactly the date, but he, when he was being arrested, he yelled out. He said, "I'm not a Dutchman. I'm an Afrikaner. Ich bin ein Afrikaner," saying that I'm not part of the Dutch culture anymore. I'm no longer a cog within the Dutch East India Company. I'm now a free man. I'm now my own thing here in Africa. There's a long history of that. So now let's jump a little bit forward to 1806. In that article that you referenced, I actually use the story of the history of the Afrikaners to demonstrate my point, all these different points in history. And the other big point is 1806. So 1806, the British annex the Cape and pretty much take over the entire Cape, and now they are anglicizing the entire Cape. So the Dutch settlers here are being told that you're going to either become nice Englishmen or you're going to face some consequences. Your children are going to go to English schools, and you're going to be anglicized. So a large portion of them leave everything behind. I mean, they had everything to gain from living under the boots of empire, or being incorporated or assimilated into the empire. They were going to get better security, better job opportunities, better schools, better food, better supplies, better consumer goods. Everything would have been better, except the price you have to pay is cultural subjugation and cultural pretty much assimilation. And that was a price too high to pay for them. So they left all their farms and all their possessions and everything they had behind and trekked into the interior. That's where the Great Trek happens in the 1800s. Then let's fast forward a little bit more, and that's going to be my final point. The Anglo-Boer War. There were two Anglo-Boer Wars, the first and the second. The first one, the Boers won. Second one, the English won. Second one is a lot more famous than the first one. And here you have a historical event so bizarre to the Western mind to make sense of, that people just ignore it, or people just kind of don't really want to talk about it. Because here you have an imperial force invading two sovereign republics, the Orange Free State and the Transvaal Republic, or the ZAR, and pretty much trying to colonize them. A European force trying to colonize another group, one Western empire trying to colonize two other Western republics. And then in the end, as we all know, that war ending with horrific scorched earth policy, where all the Boer farms are burned down and destroyed, and all the women and children are put into concentration camps, where a third of the entire Boer population dies in those concentration camps, 30,000 women and children. More women and children, Afrikaner women and children, die in those concentration camps than soldiers on both sides combined. So you've got a horrific historical event that just doesn't fit in anywhere if you look at it from a modern Western lens. I mean, the story of colonization is a story of Europeans colonizing Black African countries or regions. But now here you have a story of Europeans not only trying to colonize other Europeans and destroy them and destroy their society and their republics, but also putting them into concentration camps, pretty much committing some of the worst war crimes in history. That's why I wanted to end on that. So all of that I've explained now is a very condensed version of it, but it tells you the story of a people that don't fit into, oh, they're just white colonists box. And it just breaks the Western mind. Westerners living outside of South Africa look at the Afrikaner culture and they just knee-jerk put us into the colonists box because that's the only thing that they can do, because that's the only type of history they know. But it's not. It's like trying to put an orange into a basket that says fruit. It you can put it in there, but it's not correct. And that's what makes the Afrikaner so fascinating, specifically as an Afrikaner looking at history and thinking about identity and what you are and where you come from. It's a fascinating place to be in, but it's also a frustrating place to be in.
That's very interesting. I saw something today, actually, something along the lines of, if you can fit your entire position on a poster or on a protest sign, then your position is not nuanced enough. So if you just to, you know, use the phrase, you're just colonialists. It's just too simple. History is often far more complicated than that. Mm. And, I could maybe broaden that and just say that you'd have to, you know, it would be like trying to put one of Shakespeare's plays on a protest sign to capture all the nuance of what's actually going on. And people don't want to read that. People want sound bites. They want snippets. Mm. But thank you for elaborating on that. And so is it difficult for modern Westerners to see that? Because the ideology swimming around them, or I should say the ideologies that they're swimming in, the narrative and the narratives that they're used to, this is just it's like a complete pothole in the road, speaking of South Africa. it's a complete deviation to everything that we expect, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. I think it's because any Western country, whether it be England or France or Portugal, they all only know a history of Western country. The only interaction they know, the historical interaction between the West and Africa they know, is the dynamic of colonizer and colonized. But now they encounter a people that doesn't fit that mold, and it doesn't compute. They haven't been exposed to that type of history or that group even exists, because the Afrikaners are very unique in this sense. I can't really think of another example of a Western people in that position to not go into the thick of it. But there's another interesting thing that I think adds to this. So yeah, in the previous point where I said the Moroccans understand it, though, because their minds aren't West. They haven't been, they're not looking at it from a Western lens. They're looking at it from a colonized lens. They're looking at it from a lens people understand what a colonizer is and what a someone that is colonized is. So they see what's being done or has been done in the past to Afrikaners, and they see it as, no, this they're something different. There's an interesting story that one of my Tswana friends told me about when the Tswana tribes first encountered the Afrikaners and the Brits here in South Africa. They didn't see them as the same race. They saw them as two races. But they didn't have names or like a title for them. They just said they saw one group of people, white people, coming here, taking as much as they can, loading it up onto ships, and the ships go to wherever. They don't know where they go. They just loaded up them on all these resources onto these ships, and sometimes they get on the ships and the ships go away. And they see this other group of white people that do completely the opposite. They come here and they build houses, they build churches, they build communities, they have children, they plow the land. All their behavior screams, we're here to stay. We are building a future here, and they are acting as if 10, 20 generations into the future, they're still going to be here. And they said, of those people, they said, Bena Lefatse, which means they have the soil. They work the soil, and they are part of the soil is part of them. They are mixing themselves with the soil. And that was the distinction that they made between the two different groups of white people that they encountered. But another writer that actually demonstrates that distinction is Alistair Sparks. So Alistair Sparks wrote a great book called The Mind of South Africa, which is an excellent historical account of all the way from 1652 to 1991, the entire history of South Africa in 500 pages. And then every chapter focuses on a different group. So the one chapter will focus only on the coloureds. The other chapter will only focus on the Indians. The other chapter will only focus on the Afrikaners. And it's a fascinating read. I would recommend it. I have some criticisms of it as well, but that's a topic for another day. But in that book, he makes an interesting point. He says, and he wrote this book, the book was published in 1991, I think. And he comes to the conclusion where he says, as he's written this book now, you can see everything building up to an election on a democratic South Africa. And but he sees there's a cultural anxiety amongst Afrikaners that he doesn't quite see in the same level of intensity among English white South Africans. And he says he understands it because him as an English-speaking white South African, if this new South Africa experiment doesn't work, if it is an abject failure, he can always just immigrate to England, America, Australia, New Zealand, the entire Anglosphere, and he will still be surrounded by people that share his heritage, speak his language, has the same worldview as him, has a connection to the empire, has a very, very similar identity to him. He will still be amongst his own people. But for the Afrikaners, this is make or break. If this experiment doesn't work, they are going to be in a very, very, very difficult position. They have nowhere to go. That's what he wrote in 1991. And that shows just one of the another examples that shows the distinction.
Yeah, it's a very unique place in history, and almost like to be a. Almost, I'll say it in Afrikaans and then I'll translate it. But om 'n toerist te wees in jou geboorteland. To be a tourist in your homeland is, I think, the kind of underlying angst that a lot of South Africans feel. But it's almost it's a paradox, right? Because if you're a tourist in your homeland, then when you go back home, well, it's where you've always been. So if you lose that destination that you're visiting, well, that you've actually lost home. So that, I think, speaks to that anxiety you're talking about. Yeah. So I want to turn to that article you wrote, A Time to Dig Trenches, which I'm going to link in the description of this video, because I think it's definitely worth a read by anybody who's watching this. If anybody's listening to this and they're interested, I think they'd love that article. In the article, you write the following. You say, Afrikaners have struggled for centuries with many of the existential questions that are only now emerging in the West. In South Africa, the future has already happened. How has the future already happened in South Africa?
The future has already happened in South Africa because I think it was Samuel Huntington that said, no, it wasn't Samuel Huntington. It was, I forgot his name now, but it's not my idea. South Africa is, and he said this already in the 19th century, a famous political scientist. He said, South Africa is the West in micro, the world West within the world in microcosm. The West is a tiny minority within the rest of the world. And in South Africa, the Western population or those with a Western heritage are a minority. Those with a Western heritage in South Africa are, again, and this is why the future has already happened, we are the first large grouping of Westerners to live in a post-Western country. And this is something that Samuel Huntington has wrote a lot about. He wrote an excellent essay called The West and the Rest in 1997. I recommend everyone go read it. He writes about pretty much predicts the multipolar world that's coming and that we can see forming already today. And he writes about the dangers for the West within that world, where the West has overplayed its luck and has fallen to hubris, where we wanted to turn the entire world Western, but we never asked whether the world wanted to be Western or not. We just thought, well, it's going to be for their own good. They're going to thank us later. And the West, in its hubris, never stopped to think, but maybe the rest, as Huntington said, will actually resent us for this imperial project of ours. And why South Africa is the future has already happened is in many regards. So firstly, like I said, the first grouping of Westerners to live as a minority in a post-Western country, a country that is de-Westernizing and de-developing. The other thing is the type of solutions that are being developed in South Africa is the future. This is what's going to happen in the rest of the world as well as government capacity starts to deteriorate. The pattern that we see in South Africa of government corruption and deterioration is and state deterioration is not unique to South Africa. It's the world is the many parts of the Western world are South Africanizing. You see a lot of the same problems that we've been experiencing for a long while popping up in other countries in the Western world as well and intensifying. And that's where the future lies, is that you're going to have to be able to have an answer to these questions. And you can't just answer, well, if we just vote harder, we can get out of this. I think in America, you're seeing it happen. You're seeing it in Europe also a little bit. This is another aspect of how South Africa is the future. We already live in a post-political society, I think, where people don't vote for parties based on policy positions or whoever is the leader at that time. They support political parties almost on a tribal level, almost like if you support a football team. I mean, I'm gonna be an ANC voter till I die, or I'm gonna be my father was a DA voter and I'm gonna be a DA voter, whatever. That's the type of mentality that you're seeing. You look no further than the ruling party. You have a ruling party that oversaw state police massacre protesting mine workers with live ammunition, and they're still in power. Like, where else in the world does that happen? And here's the thing. They still get a majority of the votes. But this is happening in America, increasingly happening in America and in Europe as well, specifically in America, where people just vote Democrat or Republican because that's their team. This is our tribe. I'm red tribe or I'm blue tribe. It's post-politics. It's no longer about, okay, every election I'm going to sit back, read all the policy positions, and I'm going to make an educated decision on who I'm going to be voting for this year. It's like, no. That's not what's going on. What's happening is people are just voting for their team because it's their tribe, no matter what they do. So that's my last point, would be why we're living in the future here in South Africa and the rest of the world is just catching up and South Africanizing.
Do you think there was ever a time where people really tried to understand the policies before they voted? Where people sat and...
It would depend on which case studies you use. If you use America as a case study, absolutely. You see massive swings from a Democrat to Republican in America throughout their history in the 19th century. You see it in many European countries as well, big in England's history as well, between the Conservative and Labour. But it was never as crystallized and entrenched as it is now, where it's just, especially America is the best example, where people just have dug the trenches for the wrong reasons, and now they're just fighting for their political tribe, which is on the topic of identity, a horrible place to be. I mean, these are the fake identities of the modern world. Is like, I'm a Democrat voter, I'm a Republican voter, or I'm a Star Wars fan, or I'm a whatever, I'm a gamer, whatever. All these empty identity markers that people use today in the modern world as imitations of something that was real in the past. I mean, the identity of I'm a Christian, or the identity of I'm a Westerner, or the identity of I am an Afrikaner, that comes with a rich history, that comes with values, that comes with principles, that comes with a worldview. Identity of I'm a gamer, or I'm a an Apple fan, I'm an Apple consumer, or I'm transgender. Like, that doesn't come with anything. It's empty little shell identities that if you scratch the surface, the whole thing just collapses. But that's what we live with today. And politics has become the same, where just as you, like I said, as you support a football team, you now just vote for a certain party and that's it. Win or lose, human rights abuses or not.
I think sometimes it's easier to adopt those identities because the real identities you mentioned related to where you come from, your ancestry, those place certain expectations on you and they put pressure on you, especially the one of being a Christian, right? I personally don't think there's something wrong with if I ask somebody if they like video games and then they say, oh yeah, I'm a gamer.
Yeah.
But he and I both understand
yeah
what he's saying, right?
Yeah.
He's not but if he actually thinks that's his whole his whole thing that and you know he tries to convince me that gaming brings just as much meaning to life as having a family or looking at a beautiful sunset, at that point I wouldn't have to argue with him. The position would just be silly as he said it,
right?
So I think it's convenient and it's easy for all of us to crave identities which just don't require much from us, don't push us into personal change. And ideally, I think of an identity almost like an ideal that you want to aspire towards, right? So if you say, well, I am this, and what we often do is instead of changing ourselves to fit the ideal, we change the ideal to fit ourselves,
right?
Which I think is what's happening a lot these days, right? It's just a lot easier and a lot more convenient. Because when you tie yourself to an identity, like you said, it introduces a whole worldview, and now suddenly that worldview looms over you, and it requires something from you.
And why I kept bringing the conversation back to identity and why I wanted to talk about it is, I think it is already one of the defining questions of our time, and this is not my idea that I came up with. That Samuel Huntington that I mentioned earlier wrote in 1997, and I quote, "In the post-Cold War world, the most important distinctions among people are not ideological, political, or economic. They are cultural. People and nations are attempting to answer the most basic question humans can face. Who are we?" Close quote. That's what everyone on an individual and on a collective level are struggling with. Identity. Who are we? Who am I? Who am I as Dylan? Who am I as Arons? That's the question everyone is trying to answer. Who are we as Afrikaners? Who are we as Christians? Who are we as Westerners? Who are we as South Africans? And Fancel Slabbert, a South African writer and political philosopher, wrote about the hierarchy of identities. And I think this will be very relevant to what you were saying earlier. Every one of us, you, me, everyone, has a hierarchy of identities. And the higher up an identity is in that hierarchy, the more rooted it is, and the more deeply rooted it is, and the harder the more difficult it will be for someone, and more traumatic it will be for someone to give up that identity. So, for example, you have many identities. I have many identities. You are a Christian. You are an Afrikaner. You are an Afrikaans speaker. You're a man. You're a father. You live in Gauteng. You're a South African. You're a Springbok supporter. You're a gamer. You're a podcaster. You're a YouTuber. All of those things are all different identities, but they're all on a different level. I don't think anyone is going to tell you their identity as a Christian is on the same level as their identity as the person that lives in Church Street. But as someone that living in that street is a certain type of identity, or living in a certain town or city in Pretoria or Malmesbury or whatever, it's a level of identity, but it's much lower. So the lower it is down on that hierarchy, the much easier it is to give up. So, for example, I'm a Christian and an Afrikaner is high up on my hierarchy of identities, but my identity as a enjoyer of G.K. Chesterton is not in my top five. So if someone were to say, give up your identity as a Christian, or you are never allowed to read G.K. Chesterton again. It's going to take me 1 second to make that, not even a second, to make that decision. But that demonstrates my point of some identities are very easy to give up when a metaphorical gun is put against your head. Other ones, giving them up would be so traumatic, it would rip your entire psyche apart.
Yeah, I mean, on a slight tangent, it's also like some addictions can lead to identities. Like I used to smoke, and I remember I got to a point where somebody would ask me, "Are you a smoker?" And I said no, and I realized, oh, it's no longer even in the hierarchy to use your terminology. Some identities have to die in service of higher identities, and sometimes a new identity comes along, like a Christian. And that just, or a father. Not only, and people don't always want that. You know, there's many cases of people who accidentally become a father, if I could just speak loosely for a moment, and they don't want that identity, but in a sense, the identity is larger than you. You don't get to choose some identities, they choose you, if that makes sense. Right. But I really want to go on to the next point, which is still related to the article. And I want to read you something you wrote. Now, I want to get your thoughts on it. I have a question following up on it as well. So in that article, you write, "The benefit of living in good times is that you have ample opportunities to live a comfortable life. The advantage of living in hard times is that you have plenty of opportunities to live a great life. So I've thrown my lot in with the trench diggers of South Africa. To live dangerously on the margins of human expansion like a leopard in the Western Cape Mountains, it is better than growing fat and living safely in a concrete zoo." So my question for you is, what would you say to someone who says, "Look, I don't see the point in digging the trenches. I'd be better off just moving overseas because, you know, I got to think about the safety of my children right now in the short term."
Well, I have a short answer and a longer answer. My short answer is just that, believe me, the waters of chaos are rising, and you can flee to higher ground, but at some point there's going to be no more higher ground to flee to. At some point, you're going to have to hunker down and dig a trench. I'm not going to make moral judgment on anyone that has immigrated from South Africa. That's a deeply personal choice that you yourself and your family make. But I will make a moral judgment on someone that immigrates somewhere, and as soon as the going gets tough, they as well moves to the next place and the next place, and just becomes a prosperity merchant. Prosperity mercenary, where you just go from place to place where things are going well, and then when the going gets tough, you just move on to the next prosperous place. Those people I will make a moral judgment on. You are outsourcing the solving of these problems to your children or your children's children, and that is morally abhorrent, and I'm not going to beat around the bush about that. But the thing about whether to move or whether to dig a trench is, again, a question that you're going to have to answer for yourself. This is not something that I can normatively tell that everyone, wherever you are now, you have to hunker down. Sometimes some positions are not winnable, but you also have to take into account that some positions where you might be moving to might be a worse position than the one that you are in now. Just an example. So this very article, I was on a podcast to talk about it on Oren McIntyre's YouTube channel. And I was invited to talk about this because there was a big online debate raging in the United Kingdom because Peter Hitchens, the brother of Christopher Hitchens, wrote an opinion piece where he said young English men need to emigrate. There's nothing left for them in this country. They need to leave. And then he got into a massive debate with many other public intellectuals on this point. And now Oren invites me on his podcast to talk about time to dig trenches or time to move. And I just immediately say, I have to get this out there, that I find it deeply, deeply ironic and funny that I'm on this podcast to talk about whether people in England need to stay or immigrate. And England is the number one destination where South Africans immigrate to. It's a funny world we live in.
It is.
That's that just shows that point where you sometimes you have to really take stock of the position that you are in and the real costs of leaving and the costs of staying. Costs of staying, can I count the ways? I mean, we can sit here for an hour and I can list you all the costs of staying. But a lot of people, unfortunately, are not willing to talk about the costs of leaving. And to maybe bring this back to G.K. Chesterton, because I know a lot of your subscribers will enjoy and know or recognize the connection. So G.K. Chesterton recognized this principle when he said, the principle that I'm going to talk about now, men did not love Rome because she was great. Rome was great because they had loved her. And this is unfortunately what's happening today, where, no, and don't get me wrong, I'm not talking about South Africa now specifically. I'm talking about the phenomenon of a world on the run. People just, things start going bad and you move to another place where things aren't going so bad. The best example of that is, mobile work or remote work, where you just sit on your laptop, you can do your work from home, from anywhere. So what do a lot of people do? Oh, they now move from the city to small little countryside, beautiful, picturesque, postcard countryside towns, go do their work there, and they move away from all the problems that were surrounding them in their own community. What's the problem? The problem is exactly what G.K. Chesterton was talking about. You're moving to a oasis of order and beauty without any comprehension of why it's a beautiful, peaceful place. I'm generalizing strongly here. Many people do realize, but a lot of people don't. They're going to go pick the fruits of intergenerational sacrifices, and they don't even know about the things that made it possible. So they're moving to these small towns, but you have to ask the question, why are these little small towns still so beautiful and peaceful? The thing is, they're so beautiful and peaceful because people have been living there for generations and putting blood, sweat, and tears into keeping their aesthetic beauty, keeping them safe, keeping them tidy, keeping them an oasis of beauty and order. But now you have people, and they are able to pick the fruits of their intergenerational sacrifices. But now, in a world where you can just move very easily and freely, people are moving in there away from their own problems, moving to the places that look the best and don't have any of those problems. And they have no idea why those places are the way they are. And then one last question then that comes up, and this is where morality comes in. Those people that have moved to a different place because they couldn't solve the problems of where they did live, or couldn't face the problems where they lived, or they didn't feel like they could make a difference about it. My only question to them is, when those same problems arise in the new place where you moved to, are you willing to then hunker down and find a solution and dig a trench, or are you just going to move away again? That's why I said earlier, I can make no moral judgment on someone that moves to a place where they think is a more defendable position. But when the same problems arise that drove you away from the place where you moved away in the first place, and you move again, and you don't dig a trench, that's where I'm going to have to condemn your actions as morally abhorrent.
Fair point. I like pretty much everything you said. The initial point to me, you said you had a short answer and a long answer. The short answer, I think, was already very convincing, which is just that the problem is not reducible down to a specific set of infrastructure or a specific city or a specific town. The problem is it might be too bold to say in the hearts of men, but at least in terms of moving to a modern Western society, I think not only are some of these problems going to hit you later on, I think you're going to be dealing with a plethora, a buffet of degeneracy in the form of other problems that you don't have to deal with now, at least as a South African, speaking specifically from the South African, especially in terms of educational systems, what kids are being taught in schools. There's a whole lot of things that you're just going to have to contend with that you don't even think about now or even worry about now. And I agree with you on the other point, which is, not making moral judgments about somebody who chooses to leave, because you really don't know their background. You don't know why they made that decision. They might have might have family there and they have a great opportunity that they're never going to get again. And maybe they plan to come back one day, but they can't find work here. So you don't want to jump to conclusions, but assuming but I agree with you. There is certainly a problem with thinking that I can just run away from my problems into solutions. And then each time there's an inconvenience, just keep doing that. Mm. I just don't think that's sustainable in the long run. And I mean, at the end of your life, we talked about identity, you know, where does that really put you? Mm. You know, how do you see yourself? I wonder what the psychological impact of that is on a person over a long term of life, you know, not having roots, so to speak.
Mm.
Great answer. I'd like to move on now to your other passion. I just have one or two questions here for you, which is, you know, you said you're passionate about finding realistic state-proof solutions to problems.
Mm.
So I might maybe want to begin with the obvious question, which is, I think, probably a big question. I'm not entirely sure how I would answer it, but I think you've spent a lot more time thinking about this stuff than I have. And the question is just, in your mind, what role should the state actually play?
Mm. Well, firstly, I'm not an anarchist. I think there is a place for a state structure. I'm not on a crusade against the state. The other thing that I am against is over-centralization, which we have been picking the bitter fruits of in South Africa for centuries now. It's not something that started in 1994 or in 1961 or in 1920. It started in 1910, where we started creating a central state that administers a massive amount of territory and peoples and different cultures and religions and languages. And it is an imperial project, because that state has to administer and rule on the premise that it knows what's best for everyone. And the best and statists and centralists always answer in the same way. The best for everyone would be if everyone is just standardized, if everyone speaks the same language, everyone has the same religion or anti-religion, everyone has the same culture or anti-culture, everyone has the same worldview, everyone has the same everything. Because that makes people legible, as my friend Russell Lamberti says. It makes a population legible and administrable. You start it's very difficult to administer a population that disagrees on religion, language, culture, everything. But if they're all the same, then it becomes legible and administrable. And that's the thing that the statists always try. I mean, that's what Lenin tried. He wanted to standardize the Russian people. That was his project. But it was a centralist project. And that's the thing. The place for the state is that it can exist, but it also, there needs to be room for the concept of subsidiarity. This idea that comes from Johannes Althusius, the father of the federal idea. And his idea of subsidiarity is that when it comes to responsibilities, the lowest and smallest social unit or social association should take up as many responsibilities as it can. Not just it should be able to, it should be taking up as many responsibilities as possible. So let's take what Johannes Althusius saw as the smallest social unit or the smallest unit in society, and that is the family. So if a family can keep itself safe and secure effectively, then it can and it should. But if it's not able to, as many families are, then that responsibility should be delegated one level up, not all the way from level 1 to level 10, where now the state has to intervene and everyone has to be at the mercy of a hopelessly ineffective South African police force. No, it should just be delegated up one level. What's the level above a family when it comes to security? A neighborhood watch. So then you delegate that responsibility one notch up in regards to centralization. So you centralize power, but very small. Another example is electricity. If a town, the social association of a town or a community, can generate effectively its own electricity, it should not be forced to get its electricity from a failing state monopoly like Eskom. it should be able to generate, it should be allowed to generate its own electricity. And not only should it be allowed to take it, generate its own electricity, it has a responsibility to. That's the concept of when it comes to what's the role of the state. I would approach it with Johannes Althusius's idea of subsidiarity. First start with the smallest association and what they can do, and then you move up from there.
Speak to your brother first, and then if need be, go to the church. Right. Go up another level. Okay, and then is there something you think that here in South Africa in particular, is there something that you think the state, or let's broaden that term, let's just say the current government administration, is there something you think that they're doing well?
They're very excellent at being a culture shredding machine. unfortunately, I don't have any love for the corrupt regime that rules over South Africa. It really changes you when you see a regime be so corrupt that they steal and loot them, even the food packages that were intended for the sick and impoverished during a pandemic. It comes a point where it's indefensible, and to even be neutral on that fact would be the evil stance. You need to be able to morally condemn what you're seeing around you in regards to an evil regime, and what we have in South Africa is an evil regime. So they're doing well is just destroying languages and cultures and the genuine diversity that we have in South Africa. The ruling regime in South Africa has no interest in diversity. Don't let their rhetoric fool you. If they, for example, had any love for genuine diversity, they would have developed the language, one of the many languages in South Africa, to a tertiary education level. But no, what do they do? Rather than develop the different languages in South Africa to a tertiary education level, they just standardize everything. All the schools are going to be English now. All the universities are going to be English now. Sorry, you actually achieved a linguistic miracle by developing Afrikaans from a kitchen language to a tertiary education PhD language within less than 100 years. Only three other languages in the world have achieved that. Oh, you've got the entire recipe and blueprint on how to do it. No, well, we're just going to throw that away and take your. We're going to throw that away, and we're going to take all these institutions that you built for Afrikaans speakers, which is a massive language in South Africa. Millions of South Africans speak it. The majority of them not even white. We're just going to take away that opportunity for them. They're going to be English now, and then people wonder why. The other day, Carte Blanche reported that 80% of grade 4 learners in South Africa can't read with comprehension. What does that mean? They read, but nothing sticks, nothing registers. What's the root of that? The root of that is that the South African government has done this evil standardization experiment of second language education, which has horribly failed. When studies have shown, when students, specifically on primary school level, are taught in their home language, their performance increases by over 50%. This is the reality that the ANC government just are so drunk on ideology that they can't even try to implement it. So you're sitting with a regime, just to wrap up, we're sitting with a regime that only pays lip service to cultural, linguistic, religious, and community-based diversity or geographic diversity. But all their policies, every single one of their policies does exactly the opposite. Every single one of their policies has two very distinct objectives. The one objective is to standardize the population in every aspect, and the second objective is to centralize as much power in the hands of the state as possible. You can't name me a single example in the history of South Africa in the past 30 years or you can go even farther back in the past 75 years of South Africa since the beginning of apartheid in 1948. You can't name a single example of the central government giving up power to the community level or to a smaller level. It's always been a project of centralization for over 100 years. over 100 years, it's just been centralizing power, centralizing power, centralizing power. And the ANC and the National Party are no different in this regard.
So, thank you for that answer. Thank you for your honesty. You brought him up, so I guess I'll go into the last question with a quote, which is Chesterton famously said that having hope is really only a virtue when things seem hopeless. So when things seem like they're gonna work out, you actually don't need hope. It's only when things are hopeless that hope actually becomes a real virtue that you can rely on. Just like if forgiveness means anything, it actually means forgiving the unforgivable, which is a very difficult thing for us to do. Is there in your mind any room for hope?
Absolutely. I mean, if there wasn't, I would not be in the line of work that I am. I mean, I've pretty much, like I said in that piece, I've thrown my lot in with the trench diggers. I'm betting the house and I'm betting the farm on a future here in South Africa. I mean, I've made this point to many on foreign podcasts as well. I said, if this is just a LARP, if this is just a live action role play, it's probably one of the most dangerous and stupid live action role plays online at the moment. People that stay in a collapsing, dysfunctional society, a society that they know they have no hope for the future. That's the thing, is I'm putting my money and my future where my mouth is. If I was sitting in London, I was talking about how there's hope for South Africa, I mean, you'd be right in mocking me. But I'm here. I'm working on the future of many other people at AfriForum, but also many other communities that I've had the opportunity to work with through many of our initiatives. There's a lot of people in South Africa all around you that are willing and able and brave enough to work towards a future and have hope for the future. And you have to realize, many people on the outside looking in, it's exactly that point that you made now, where when things are going well, it's very easy to say, I'm going to bet everything I have on the future here. But to have hope for the future, pretty much. But exactly as you said, when the going gets tough and it really gets tested, that's where hope needs to be genuine. It needs to be real. False hope or hope that is just a live action role play is not gonna happen. Not gonna work. It's not gonna cut it. So I've, in my own, what gives me hope for the future in South Africa is my experience as growing up in South Africa, the people and communities and organizations that I've been exposed to in my short life here is what gives me hope for the future. I've met thousands of people from all different backgrounds, communities, histories, legacies, heritages, languages, cultures, races, that are willing to work towards the future, that know what needs to be done, that are not scared of hard work, and that are willing to put in the man hours, to put in the blood, sweat, and tears, to put in what's necessary to build a future here. With those people, I'll fight in the trenches with them. I'll dig trenches with them. And it's like I said, this is not a project where every man for himself. Once we start creating little oases of order and taking back responsibility from the government, it starts snowballing. The best example is the potholes that AfriForum fills. So when we fill tens of thousands of potholes every year, those potholes don't discriminate. Those potholes don't ask the people driving over them, every one of them, like, are you an AfriForum member? Are you an Afrikaner? Are you Afrikaans speaking? Are you a Christian? No, they're just there and people can use them, whether they are support AfriForum or not. Another example is our neighborhood watches. Our neighborhood watches keep there's over 165 neighborhood watches, AfriForum neighborhood watches all across the country, and they keep many communities safe, but those communities are majority non-AfriForum members. Those communities are majority non-AfriForum affiliated people, but they benefit from the neighborhood watch and they benefit from the oasis of order that's being created there. And that's the mentality we're going to have to take forward, is you have to realize that when people start working together to build a future, to create order, to restore order, and to create prosperity for small little oases in the desert, that doesn't mean that they are only doing it exclusively for themselves. That little circle that they're creating is going to grow and it's going to expand out the more people get involved with it. And that's why I'm very fortunate to be in the solutions industry, because I get exposed to this on a daily basis. I see on a daily basis communities working together, people coming together, working hard and being committed to building a better future for their children here in South Africa. And I wish I could share that experience, like beam it into the minds of everyone around me so that they can see what I've seen. But that's the thing that's giving me hope. That's why I'm here to stay. And I'm very excited about the future of what many different organizations and communities and individuals are building here for the future.
Wonderful. Wonderful answer, man. I appreciate your candor. Appreciate your frankness. I think that's a wonderful place to end this conversation. But before we do, you can plug your channel and your work much better than I can. So I'm just going to let you just tell the audience, if somebody just watched this, they had never heard of you, but they were very interested in what you had to say. What's the next thing they should do? Where should they go? What should they look out for? What's a project you're working on right now? Let us know.
Well, firstly, thank you very much for the opportunity, Dylan. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I'll gladly speak to you again in the future. Where people can find me, my YouTube channel and my Twitter account, both of them called Conscious Caracal. You can see it there on the screen. I always joke when people say, so what was your plan? How did you create this YouTube channel? And what was your long-term plan? I'm like, if I had a long-term plan at the beginning, I would have chosen a username that's easier to spell. I mean, this was really just the username that I thought up in the spur of the moment.
Yeah, look who you're talking to. Existential is not exactly the the easiest to spell either. But anyway, sorry.
So they can find me there. Continue. And if they want to see my, outside of that, if there's work that I want to show off, I would just direct people to go watch my documentary called Self-Bastir about state-proof solutions for the future. It's on YouTube. It's on AfriForum's YouTube channel. It has English subtitles, if you're not able to understand Afrikaans, you will be able to follow along. That would be the last thing that I shall. That's it.
Thank you so much, Ernst, for your time again, and just wishing you all the best in your endeavors, and keep fighting the good fight, man. God bless you.
Thank you very much. God bless. Walk well. Hou moed en hou koers. You.